Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission. Here with episode 191 of Weed All About It, or what I entitled Douglas Pool's Badge of Honor, Farming in North Douglas County 2. The continuation of my absorbing conversation with the former president of the Pacific Northwest Direct Seed Association and a dryland wheat farmer experimenting with cover crops in a harsh environment. In this episode, Poole and I talk more about his farming practices, which include a cutting-edge component, but relies primarily, as he relates ahead, on more familiar farming patterns for income. Familiar patterns anyway, as they pertain to direct seeders with a yen to push the envelope. Poole and I also talk about the Conservation Reserve Program, a program that initially passed Congress as part of the 1985 Farm Bill. Although it was originally intended to reduce a U.S. surplus grain glut, it has since morphed into an environmental program. You'll hear Poole talk about the SAFE program to protect sage grouse, an offshoot of CRP. It stands for Sharp-Tailed Grouse State Acres for Wildlife Enhancement and pays farmers for retiring land to protect the species. There is no doubt that CRP was a godsend for many farmers and landlords, but as Poole points out ahead, it hollowed out a generation of farmers. Poole and I talk about his good fortune in having the right kind of landlords, good timing, and a family who has gone along with his vision for the future. But with all that, it was still tough sledding getting back to the farm. After graduating from WSU with an accounting degree, Poole got a job at the state auditor's office and attempted to return to the farm a couple of times before the move stuck in 2010. He was working as director of finance for the Educational Service District in Wenatchee at the time. That job, too, was a lucky break, as it is where Poole says he absorbed the lesson of learning as a lifelong pursuit. Not one to think he has all the answers, Poole told me he converted his Facebook presence from knowing what's going on with his friends and neighbors into a repository for articles on soil health, direct seeding, and other cutting-edge farming techniques. He has 1,300 saved and adds about 20 articles, posts, and other bits of information daily. But he laughs when admitting that he only has time to read 3 or 4 items from his trove each day. I begin the second part of our conversation by asking Poole about an article I found in which he is quoted as saying that he is not farming a particular crop, he's farming moisture. I ask him what moisture farming looks like.
We have to farm moisture. I don't have irrigation. We're 6 to 9 inches of rainfall a year. We're running half of that right now. And so, you know, just quite simply, just in a regular no-till system, we have to have that ground cover. But it, obviously, moisture's king, you know, and in everything that we're trying to do, we have to have that moisture either for the cash crop or for the cover crop. But I'm just fascinated. It's a self-perpetuating cycle. Once you get that root structure, that soil structure in place, holding moisture is not difficult at all, even in these dry times. And again, that's back to my story about the field where we were actually able to go places with the drill we'd never been before because, you know, there was structure there. There was we had something for the wheels to grab onto. once you make that move and get that investment made and get that return, now all of a sudden it you can go back to that cash crop. Because you've got the moisture, you've got that organic matter, you've got soil structure that will support all of those things. It's, you know, I'm not telling you anything you haven't already heard. It's so interrelated. There isn't just one thing. And I for myself, that was probably, and upon reflection, I have moved from thinking it's going to be one thing. It's going to be that one fertilizer, that just that one $5 input that's going to make the difference. And it's not, in my case. It's 100 things that need to change, and they're all interrelated. There's no way to remove one from the other.
You're in the midst of harvest as we speak. Now, I remember covering direct seeding when I was a reporter 20 years ago, and farmers who were direct seeding told me that the process, the practice, starts at harvest. Do you agree, and how do your harvest practices support that notion?
Yeah, quite simply, we cut lower, and every machine's got a chopper, no more spreaders. And so we're spreading that residue out, obviously trying to cover everything so we can hold that moisture that next year. And by spreading it the width of the header, we're not creating a place for diseases. The old chaff row, and I still see them in some of my fields. Sometimes the chaff row, that just promotes disease. And especially where, again, in our discussion, it needs to be pointed out, a majority of my farm is still, it's just a no-till fallow rotation with either winter, some sort of, it's not even a diversity, it's just an alternation with the canola and the wheat and the sunflowers and the oats. But they're still monoculture crops. But yeah, it definitely starts at harvest. And we learned that the hard way. Again, I mentioned the cattle. One of the ways that we do manage our residue is with vertical tillage or coulters. That's still diesel, that's still equipment, that's still repairs and everything else. And as I mentioned earlier, we put the cows out in our heaviest stubble, and it seeds up so much better. The cows are the natural vertical tillage. Again, Mother Nature gave us that livestock, and we're just trying to implement those and use those to the best of our abilities. And cows are, they kind of work for free. They don't expect a paycheck, and I don't need to diesel them in the morning, and I usually don't have to put their wheels back on.
What kind of plants are you using in the mix for your cover crop?
Let's see. I've got some peas, some sorghum, mung beans, sun hemp, obviously safflower, sunflowers. We'll put some collards in, some millets, radishes. Just trying to get, we're kind of looking at the, who plays nice with others. There's a lot of research. There's so much work that has been done, and so much work that, in other countries. That's, somebody asked me, could you have done this 20 years ago? I don't think I couldn't have anyway. There were people that were doing it. I couldn't have, because without the internet, I wouldn't have known what was going on in New Zealand and Australia and Canada and all these other places. But there's so much data and research out there with, who is going to work well with other species and everything else. And it's more around just trying to mimic what you have in your own environment.
Douglas, you're up there in an area that is lucky to get 10 inches of moisture annually, and you're planting cover crops. And certainly I talk to farmers who are in areas with 25 inches of moisture annually, and they're not planting cover crops and believe that they can't plant cover crops. I know that the direct seeders always talk about mindset, but can you address why there is this discrepancy between yourself and farmers elsewhere?
That would be a hard one to answer, because I don't know. You just don't know what everybody else's situation is. In my case, I'm lucky. I've got amazing landlords. And after I had my landlord meeting, and we had a full day presentation and a field trip, we actually went out and looked at one of the cover crops. And I would tell you that in my case, I created a monster. Now I've got landlords sending me soil health articles and wanting to know when we're going to get covers on their ground. And so to try to answer your question, I'm sure landlords are a big barrier. Again, banking, you ask that economically, how can you make this change? And I've just put it in my own budget that it's an investment. It's just part of the budget that those acres are not going to be in production. Again, we're continuing to work and try to figure out how we can still have a return on those cover crops. And obviously the cattle are going to play a big role in that. But, you can tell I struggle with that, because it's not fair to compare and contrast another another grower either here or anywhere else, just because you don't know, you know, the external forces that are going on. If you take anything out of it, I would tell you I'm just pretty darn lucky in all of this, from finding a cattle partner to I just have the good fortune of working with neat people, and I've got a family that's beyond amazingly supportive. You know, this was a real retooling at a time where things are economically depressed, and I've got a dad and another uncle who I farm for that, you know, have been more than willing to support me through this. They kind of raise an eyebrow every once in a while, but I'm just lucky. I feel bad that, you know, if there's other people that want to go down this journey that can't because of some of those external forces, but I understand those and just have the good fortune of not having that.
All right. Let's switch gears a little bit here. When I first moved to Spokane in 1986, I worked for the Capital Press, but I was also freelancing for USA Today, and I did a story for USA Today about the Conservation Reserve Program to look at the impact of the program. I drove to Mansfield, which is nearby where you farm, because it was a place that was going to be hard hit by taking acres out of production. How did CRP ultimately affect your region, and what's happening now as more land is coming back into production?
When I was in high school when CRP came along, there were 23 boys in high school at that time, freshman through senior, 22 of us either grew up on a farm or had something to do with a farm. My son graduated from Mansfield in 2015, and he was the only one in the high school that had anything to do with the farm. And so it changed the demographic. The population of Mansfield is still 350 people, but the demographic significantly changed. And so the other thing it caused was, and I think you're seeing this everywhere, but I can't even begin to tell you how many farms there were when I grew up. You know, that number's now down probably under 20. And it was probably three times that, you know, different family farms and whatever else in the North Douglas area. And so it's caused, you know, obviously consolidation. And so farms have just gotten bigger. Interestingly enough, in North Douglas County, because of the sage grouse, we're trying to keep all the CRP in we can. Douglas County was always a waiver county. We were always able to exceed a cap. And that legislation, the story goes, literally clerically got left out of the last farm bill. And so right now we're scrambling to try to keep those acres in. They're probably back in 2014, there was quite a few acres came out. I would tell you that there's probably a lot of those guys that are wishing they didn't have to bring it out because it wasn't their productive ground to start with. But there's guys that took that out with no-till, and they're being fairly successful with that ground. Everybody always sees a huge yield bump, even if it's full tillage, and they have to till it four or five times to try to get it down to where they can seed through it. There's always a beautiful yield that first year afterwards. Well, Mother Nature's telling us, hey, look, I had all this, all the biology was functioning good, and it's all here. And even though we came and we tilled and tilled and tilled so we could get through it, that residue or that residual soil biology is there, and the monoculture wheat crop that is usually planted into that thrives. It's that second crop where you really just see the crash. And I've observed that in many, many different fields.
Douglas, how important are government programs to your bottom line, and do you try to take advantage of all the programs available?
I do. They're vital. In my case, I wouldn't farm without them. The bank wouldn't let me. There's not enough margin in 40 bushel wheat at $5 to pay the equipment and pay the expenses, and so they're extremely vital. But I think they're besides the financial side of it. Again, I mentioned earlier, we have an amazing NRCS office. They're understanding this journey and they're wanting to be out here. And so I leverage those programs just so I can get to the expertise and have them on my farm, you know, throwing out ideas, using their knowledge and database to determine how we're going to make this, basically how we're going to return this to what Mother Nature did and work within the system as opposed to working against it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of drill are you using? And did you use any equip funds to purchase the drill?
Yeah, I used a, got an, it was actually at that point in time was a, wasn't even an air quality grant. It was an energy grant. And I have a 1870, a John Deere 1870 conserver pack hoe drill. I would do anything to get to a disc drill and even eliminate the disturbance even more. I've kind of taken a little different why and have focused in on the use of covers and livestock. But at some point in time, twofold. I need to get to a disc drill just to eliminate some disturbance around here. And I need to get to a planter. We're expanding our sunflower production, and it's obvious that I cannot do that with an air drill. They need to be singulated and properly cared for. And so we're moving towards those two pieces of equipment.
Is canola your most important alternative crop?
Yes. Yeah. I will be, next year I will be 51% canola and 49% wheat. I don't know if I should be telling that to the Grain Commission.
Yes. I've always been impressed by Douglas County conservation ethos. You know, I've gone up there for tours. It's very impressive. What makes Douglas County special that way?
I'm excited to say that it's North Douglas County. I think I counted. There's 21 no-till drills that have come into just North Douglas County, and that's pretty much north of Highway 2 since 2013. That's a lot of no-till acres in just a very short amount of time. I don't know. It'd be nice to be able to say, here's what it is, and go sell that to somebody. But it's just a group of people that... You know, probably it's, especially when I keep referencing North Douglas County, it's like, who in the world would ever farm there? I had some friends come to we held a soil health meeting, or I can't remember what it was, and they got out of their pickup, and all four of them got out of their crew cab pickup and looked around and said, man, we always wondered what it would be like to go somewhere and say, thank God we don't farm here. And they had obviously rehearsed it, and they were like, yep, we're here. We're here. Thank God we don't farm here. And, you know, I would suppose you could interview 10 of my friends and we all say we take that as a badge of honor. We do farm here and we're proud of it. And so that, I don't know. I don't know that that answers your question. I'm on the conservation district on Foster. I sit on the board for Foster Creek Conservation District. We just hired a young gal out of North Dakota and we're very excited about her. She comes from, she actually worked for one of the, I would tell you, one of the leading extension agents in the United States. And so we were excited to get Becca. Anyway, she pretty promptly, she just has that personality. She promptly went to coffee hour in Mansfield. And she called me up later and she said, you go in there very often? And I said, well, I don't have the good fortune. She says, you know, I've been in a lot of coffee hours from Montana to Idaho to North Dakota, South Dakota. And she says, I've never been in one like that before. I'm used to it. I don't know any different, but to have that kind of comment, but it's in that coffee hour. That had to have been where all this changed. I'm sure everybody else interacts at their local sporting events and family gatherings and church events and everything else. But that coffee hour probably ought to be filmed probably for a week. It'd be a heck of a reality series, but it go back to your other question, how did CRP change? And I can't tell you that CRP changed that. It's, you know, it's fun because my generation, there's only me and one other friend that are back in my generation. Everybody left, in whether that was CRP or whatever else, because their fathers and their families and their uncles were all still young enough when that all contracted. But it was my generation that basically got squeezed out of farming. Now the generation, probably not, you know, those kids that all graduated in the mid-90s and 2000s, those kids are coming back. But there's a huge gap in North Douglas County of guys that there just wasn't an opportunity to come back. And then all of a sudden, you know, everybody that left already had careers. There wasn't the ability to come back. And so that's kind of where, you know, farms such as myself, it's just, there was no one else to farm that ground. And I just, in my case, happened to be at the right place at the right time. And I'm watching that again. I'm watching friends that are going to be able to pick up some ground. And I think everybody, that's what's fun about how they talk about it. With the advent of no-till here and the way we're able to get over more acres with less equipment makes that easier. But I suppose upon reflection, it is sad. You know, there just isn't that farming community for my generation anyway. I'm jealous of the younger kids that are all back and they all have kids together. You know, they've got their 2 to 5 year olds and their little league's kind of starting to be a thing again and everything else. It is coming back, but that's, you know, quite frankly, there's no such thing as the 750 acre a year farm anymore.
When I started in agriculture in the mid-1980s, a 2,000 acre wheat farm was big. Over the years, that has increased until today, I know several farmers with 10,000 acre farms. For those who can't visualize the area, think of 10,000 football fields, each of which is about an acre in size. I've found farmers fall into two camps when asked about how much acreage they farm. Some volunteer the information, while others are less enthusiastic about revealing what they consider a proprietary number. Poole skirted the question but provided a framework to understand his scale, disclosing that his farm is in excess of 10,000 acres. I didn't ask and he didn't say how much in excess, but I think big definitely describes the operation. I hope you've enjoyed my two episodes entitled Douglas Poole's Badge of Honor, Farming in North Douglas County 2. If you've enjoyed these episodes, please tell your friends, relatives, neighbors, and agribusiness contacts about Wheat All About It, the only Pacific Northwest podcast to concentrate on wheat growing in eastern Washington and the region. And please visit the WGC's redesigned website at wagrains.org and scroll through all 190 podcasts released over the last almost 3 years. After you've finished with the task, please join me here again next week for another new episode of Wheat All About It.
Out in the country where a woman's called a gal, she's more than a lover, she's a farmer's best pal. We marry them for life, we marry with a vow, and even in the night we know how to plow. Our children have two parents, our children have a home, they don't grow up with no edible syndrome. We're the backbone of this country, the spirit of its soul. Best you ask for whom the bell tolls. We feed you. We feed you.